This is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Katherine Burns, Artistic Director of the Moth, and I'll be your host this time. We have three stories this hour. A man struggles to get back to normal after being randomly attacked by strangers. A young backpacker accidentally finds himself on the wrong side of the Iron Curtain. And an animator is haunted by the voices in her film. Our first story is from Ed Gavigan. Ed has told a number of stories of the Moth, many of them centering around the incident at the heart of this story. Ed told it at an event we did in conjunction with Oregon Public Radio and Literary Arts in Portland, Oregon. A warning, the story involves an act of violence and may be upsetting for some listeners. Here's Ed Gavigan, live at the Moth.
You know, you wake up in the morning, you get dressed, you put on your shoes, you head out into the world, you feel like you're going to come back home at night, go to sleep, get up, you do it again. That rhythm creates the framework that you use to create a life, and you make plans, and you kind of count on continuity. And John Lennon said, life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. And I woke up one morning. I wasn't wearing any of my own clothes. I had two chest tubes. I had a hose going up my nose down to drain my stomach. I had a catheter, a morphine drip. And I woke into this fog of pain that felt like I had broken through the ice into a lake of frozen hurt. And at the end of my bed, I could see the surgeon who had spent all night saving my life. And he was holding my foot. And he had given me about a 2% chance of living. Next to him were two homicide detectives. Now, they were homicide detectives because they had gotten the case because they didn't think I was going to make it, and they didn't want to have to do the paperwork swap. And let me tell you, when you start your day with two homicide detectives explaining what happened the night before, it's downhill from there. They had they began to explain to me they had five young men in custody, and they wanted me to identify them from the mugshots before I died. And I didn't know this, but they just wanted me to make an X and next to the pictures. And what had happened is that these young men had come in from Brooklyn. They were part of a gang, and the initiation for them to move up into the upper echelons of their gang was to come into Manhattan and kill somebody. And they had set up this little ambush where they had one lookout at either end of the block. And the three guys would sit on the stoop, and they had their knives open up their sleeve like that, and they'd look out at either end, and they would wait. And it was late at night, and it was the night before Thanksgiving, so the city was really empty. And this guy walks around the corner, and he heads down the block, and the two lookouts give the go-ahead, and the three guys stand up and start walking towards him, and he has his key out, and he puts his key in the door, and he goes into the lobby, and the door closes behind him, and they're locked out, and he pushes the elevator button, and he goes upstairs, and he gets undressed, and he goes to bed, and he never knows what just didn't hit him, and I'm the next guy. And I come down the block, and one of the very lucky things from that night is when I was in University of Notre Dame, I was on the boxing team. So I got one good punch and knocked the middle guy out, and they caught him, and he gave up everybody else, which is how they had these five guys in custody. So they, nobody expected me to make it, and I did. I lived. They took me off life support, moved me into ICU, and the nurse comes in with the clipboard, and she wants to talk to me about my insurance. I was self-employed at the time, so I like to say I was insurance-free. And when she found that out, the next morning, the person that I saw said, "It's amazing how well you're doing, and we just think you ought to go home." And they gave me a bottle of Percocet and a cane and a bag to put my stuff in. And the flowers hadn't even stopped, wilted yet, you know. So I end up in my apartment at home in very bad shape. The nightmares were unbelievable. I couldn't eat. They had removed about a third of my intestines. I had had two collapsed lungs. I was missing organs that I didn't know that I had, and things were very, very difficult. And in New York, if you can't go to work and make money and pay your rent, you don't get to stay in your apartment. And I would try and walk down the street to do my job. I had a little business building custom furniture. And whenever I saw a young man that had any hint of menace, this feeling would hit me. And the feeling was, you know, if you're driving late at night in the winter on a snowy road, and you're going a little fast, and you come into a turn, and you feel all four wheels slip, and you feel the car start to go, and you see the guardrail, and you know there's nothing you can do. And then all of a sudden, you hit the dry pavement, and the wheels grip, and you're back in control, and nothing happened. And then you get hit with this adrenaline feeling in the back of your knees and your palms, and you taste in your mouth. But you're driving, and you're like, nothing happened. And I would have that feeling seeing teenage kids on the street 6, 7, 8 times a day if I tried to ride the subway, and it wore me out. I was having, in the end, what was post-traumatic stress symptoms, and I ended up losing my apartment and essentially then becoming homeless. I lost my business. And I went to the district attorney's office for an appointment where I had 5 attempted murder trials that I had to handle. And I broke down. I was crying. I was like, I can't believe, you know, I was so lucky to be alive, but now I'm homeless. And he gave me a number for the a little late, I thought, for the victims' assistance people, and but it was because I didn't talk. Like, I just kept it all in. And so I go and I talk to I sit there and I don't have an appointment or anything. I'm waiting, and this girl comes out and she's like Reese Witherspoon and Legally Blonde. She's got the turtleneck and the ponytail, and she leads me back to her cubicle, and I'm in this really dark place, and I have this feeling that we're not going to connect. And I get to her cubicle, and pinned up on the wall next to her monitor is that poster, I know you know it, of the kitten with the branch saying, hang in there, baby. And I just don't feel like she's going to help me. And she gives me this paperwork to fill out for Medicaid, and she gives me some more paperwork on how to get on a list for subsidized housing. It's an 18-month wait, but, you know, at least you're on the list. And another sheet with some addresses in the Bronx where I can go for group counseling that's free. And I feel like a drowning man who's just been thrown a kit to build a boat. And I walk out of there, and I go to my favorite bartender, who's this cute Lebanese-Canadian girl who's a poet. And she lets me move in and stay on the couch. She's rocking this Simone de Beauvoir look, and she's got this whole, like, she's smart and funny. And the thing from those days that she listened, which was amazing, because what people did, and they were all very well-meaning, but they had one of 3 responses. And the first response was, when I tried to talk about my feelings and my fear and this turmoil in my head, they would say, well, everything happens for a reason. And that made me want to punch him in the face and ask him if they knew what the reason for that was. And then the second thing that people tended to say
was you've just got to get over it, man. You're alive. You're lucky. You've just got to put this in the past and just move on and gather yourself together. And that made me want to stab them 6 times and come back and talk to them in 6 months and go, so how's it working out? You got any advice for me now? Because I could really use some help from somebody that knows what I'm going through. And the third thing that people would say, and again, they were very well-meaning, it just was absolutely no help, was that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And the problem with that was that I felt like I had come to New York, I'd started this little business, I had built a life, and I had lost everything. I'd lost my apartment, my business, I got no help. You know, this girl that had become, that let me move in with her was like getting a little worried because I was just so sad all the time. And that I felt like you could actually, I mean, I read Nietzsche, I went to college, I was up all night in the student union drinking coffee going, yeah, if it doesn't kill you, man, it makes you stronger. But I felt like I was actually broken, that things could happen in your life that would just break a man, and that you not only you wouldn't be stronger, but you would never have ever again what you had before. And I felt like things had slipped in a way that I would never be able to recover. And what I would do to try and make money and have a job is I would gather my little set of chisels and tools and go up to the Upper East Side, Manhattan, where there's always, you know, some billionaires working on his mansion, and I could see a construction site, and I'd go up and knock on the door and ask if they needed anybody to work, just a day laborer. And the foreman, you know, he sees a guy with his own tools, he knows his way around the job site, English is his first language, and they'd put me on a, you know, they'd be like, all right, you know, put him down there and see what he can do, you know, and I go and I start working, and I knew what I was doing, and I'd be in this incredible mansion being renovated, and I'd look around at the unbelievable materials, and I'd think of how lucky these people were to be living, you know, when we were done with this work, they'd be surrounded by beautiful materials and amazing craftsmanship, and I'd be there, you know, working, and I'd be, you know, making a mortise for an offset pivot hinge in a rosewood door, and the, you know, the beauty of everything that I was working on contrasted with my life, I would just start to cry. And so I'd be on my hands and knees sobbing in the library under construction, and one of the laborers would go tell the foreman, like, you know, that dude you hired, man, he's sobbing in the library. And the foreman, you know, usually this Irish guy would come and, you know, Eddie, I'm going to pay you for the day. Go have a drink, man. We don't need you anymore. And then that would be it. I'd get fired. And I was getting fired again and again. And it was always, you know, these people didn't know what happened to me. They just knew they couldn't have some guy weeping in the basement. And I couldn't hold a job. And I was getting angrier, and now, you know, she's my girlfriend, the Canadian poet bartender, but she's worried because I'm like, my attitude is not so good. And I leave after being fired yet again, I walk out onto Park Avenue, right? I've got my little bag of tools, and I see this guy walking by, and he's got his hair is perfectly coiffed, and his Hermes tie is knotted, and his shoes are shine, his impeccable suit with his shiny briefcase, and I see that guy, and I just want to tackle him and just kneel on his chest and punch him in the face and go, you know, you're not good. You're just lucky, man. You're not, you think that all of your assumptions and everything you know and all you're doing is keeping you where you are. You're just lucky because it can all just be gone. You can lose it, and I have this rage at him. I don't do anything, you know, let him keep walking. But I realize as I have that feeling that I have just wanted to hurt an innocent stranger, passerby, to make a point about what is wrong with my life. And in that moment, I realize I've become more like the kids that stabbed me. I've lost who I was before. And I go, it's an incredible feeling to feel like you're not who you used to be. And that the feeling was that I was slipping down into some place where I was going down a road where I was going to meet the guys who were my attackers, and I was going to be in hell because I would go there alone. Like, no, that path was just of bitterness, and there was no way out. And at the same time, for the first time, as I was sitting there thinking about these feelings of what was happening to me, I realized I can never get back to where I was. That guy, that business, that whole life is just gone. I lost it. But I had never believed that I'd lost it. I always thought I was trying to get back to be that guy. And as I sat there and I thought about, I realized I got to do something new. And there was this, it felt liberating. It was like, all right, I can't go back because that's gone. And I don't want to be evil and bad. And I'm going to do this new thing. And I'm like, I can do it. I have this girl. And I run home and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be the sad guy, and I'm not going to be the mad guy. I'm going to change, and we're going to work this out. Will you marry me? And she's like, no. You're like, you got to do, you know, you need a little more work here. But she's enthused by my enthusiasm, and she knows I'm never going to ask her again. So after about another year and a half, she feels like we got something. And so she asks me to marry her. And so we do. And we end up building this routine again and setting up a life. And now I have a 2-year-old daughter. And I put her shoes on in the morning, and I head out to work. Thanks.
That was Ed Gavigan. Ed designs and builds homes and furniture for people all over the world. His work has been featured in Architectural Digest and the New York Times. I recently sat down with Ed to talk about the effect telling this story has had on him. So the stories you tell involve very painful memories, and how do you prepare for telling them?
There are certain memories that are bound up in having post-traumatic stress, and that those memories are unlike anything else. Those memories live in a different part of the brain. I think even neurochemically, it's a completely separate vault for the post-traumatic stress memories. Those memories come up in a way that is just in high def and extremely vivid. And I go back to that moment. And so to kind of prepare for that, you can't, in a way. Like, you just have to, you say to yourself, I don't want to lose my composure, but there's almost no way to not have that hit you.
I was wondering about the cathartic effect of telling these stories over and over. It seems like you fully enter each story with each telling, and it helps you in some way to go back there and share these memories by taking what's inside and putting it outside. You're liberating what's private and making it public, especially shared before a big, warm audience of fellow humans. And I was wondering what you think about that.
The thing that I didn't anticipate was that by telling the story, I remind myself to be grateful, to be grateful.
To hear more of my conversation with Ed Gavigan, go to themoth.org. While you're there, pitch us your own story. Many of the most beautiful stories on the Moth main stage have been told by people who called our pitch line. In a moment, writer Nathan Englander will have a story about the hazards of traveling behind the Iron Curtain with only a mixtape, a few bucks, and the Ural Pass.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Catherine Burns. Our next story is from writer Nathan Englander. We first met Nathan at a writers' festival in Perth, Australia, and we knew after just a few conversations that we had to get Nathan to tell a story for us. Here's Nathan Englander, live at the Moth.
For those of you who are less than 100 years old, I want to tell you there used to be something called the Soviet Union. They were our arch enemy, and we were locked in a perpetual state of Cold War with them for, you know, my whole life, and, you know, until I was an adult. To contrast that to our perpetual war on terror that we're now in, you know, going around the city, we're all afraid something's going to blow up, that might blow up. Well, back then, we were afraid everything was going to blow up. We were going to melt the whole world into a tiny glass marble. The symbol of this, you know, split between East and West was the Berlin Wall, which not only divided that city, it literally divided the planet. And, you know, I think about it now, it's hard to, you know, go back to that, but it was really people would die trying to cross. They were literally trapped. They would literally dream of freedom. They would hide in trunks of cars or dig or try to hang glide, and they would be shot dead. That's how serious it was. So in 1989, I'm on my junior year in Jerusalem studying abroad, and suddenly word comes just out of nowhere, the wall has been breached. It's open. There's a crossing between East and West. People can move freely. You know, and it's not like today where, you know, Halliburton for $100 million, you know, plows the thing down. People are literally ripping it down with their bare hands with hammers and chisels. This is just unbelievable. And, you know, the only thing I can think of it in terms of today, it literally, like I say to you, like I'm announcing right now on stage, but, you know, we have peace with Iran. There's peace in the Middle East. You can go take like an Al-Qaeda bus tour of Kabul, you know, go see Osama bin Laden's coffee shop, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, it was just literally mind-boggling. Well, within like 2 seconds, people start showing up back in Jerusalem, friends and stuff, start showing up with pieces of the wall. They're going to be part of history. They're going over there, chipping at it. They're helping, you know, put the world back together. And this girl I have a crush on shows up, and she gives me a piece of the wall, and I'm holding it, and it's like holding moon rock. I mean, I'm holding it. It's got the graffiti on it. I just can't believe I'm holding it. It's such an amazing thing to be a part of, except I ain't. It's like clear to me in an instant. Like, I need to go be a part of this. So I grabbed my buddy Joel, who dragged me to Jerusalem, and we set the plan in order, and we're going to do it sort of a Jewish boy style. We're going to do sort of like a Passover slavery to freedom route. So we fly into Warsaw, and we do sort of like, speaking of bus tours, we hit all the highlights. We do Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka. We hit all our favorite concentration camps. And we end up in Prague, where we're going to take a night train to Berlin. And that's, you know, the end of this sort of heroic journey for us, which is we're going to get to Berlin in the morning. We're going to chip at the wall, cross to the west, and, you know, go home at the end of our year. It's all exciting. Well, no, we thought this is a grand plan. Nobody else seems to have thought this was the same kind of grand plan, because we are alone on this platform at night. It is pitch dark. There's nobody else there. We're just waiting on this platform in Prague. You know, tourists are just, ain't nobody else there. And basically, you know, here comes our train. We think it's our train. It starts rolling through the station, but it doesn't stop. It just keeps rolling, sort of clattering those tracks. And what it is an old freight train. Now, can I tell you, I am, you know, Long Island raised. Like, for me, I have been raised on a full-on diet of the Holocaust. You know, like, this sets instant Holocaust PTSD in my head. You know what I'm saying? You know, for those of you, like, I'm a yeshiva boy. Like, we didn't do the Diary of Anne Frank. We went, like, Clockwork Orange style, you know. From, honestly, you know, I have a friend here, she'll tell you, like, from a way too young age, they would sit us there and flash images, no joke, like piles of bodies, piles of teeth, piles of hair, you know, just, you know, combs, you know, just these really unbelievably dark images, and there's no greater symbol of it. They always did the jackboots. All those old tapes played big black jackboots, and then those trains. I mean, these are the trains that annihilated our people. They would stuff them full of Jews, and when there was no more room, they would stuff babies in over the people's head. You know, there we are standing on the same platforms. It's not like it changed. We're on the same platform. Those are the same tracks. This could be the same train that destroyed our people. You know, we're just standing there dead silent. Well, the next train is our train, and you know, we get up on it and back to the Long Island part. I know my trains, you know, Amityville, Copeg, Lindenhurst, Babylon. I know my routes. I can tell you, right, you know, sort of like on the G when to switch cars, like I know when something doesn't feel right when I step into a train car, and this feels bad. It's sort of over hot and already overpacked, and we're looking for our seats. You know, we got our numbers, and we go over to our compartment, and we open it, and we expect like two British people drinking tea. It's like the beds are open. It's six guys laid out like head to toe like sardines, and honestly, it smells of piss, it smells of beer, and most of all, it just smells of sadness. These are refugees. You know, we're on some freedom adventure. People have been trapped behind the Iron Curtain. Like, the wall has come down. People are on the move. And like a good American, I, at that time, I don't think I could point, like, Canada on a map. Like, I can't tell you today. Are they Romani or... No idea. But just refugees on the move. Well, we don't want our seats anymore, and they ain't giving them up. And we sort of look around in this packed car, and this nice family, they make room for us. You know, we take off our packs. They slide their kids over, and they let us in their compartment. And I could cry telling this to you right now. These people with nothing, they offer to share their food with us, you know? And we settle in, and we're rolling, and we're, you know, on our way to Berlin, and then the train stops. And I don't speak anything. I don't know what's happening. I don't know how they understood it, what's getting screamed, but suddenly, bedlam. You know what I'm saying? They're grabbing their stuff. You can feel it in the corridor. Everybody has to get off the train. Like, we suddenly, and there we are with those packs. We're like turtles getting jostled. We are out the train. We're not at a station. We're down the ladder. We're in the dirt, in the night, running in these groups. It's going this way and that, sort of like eddies and rivers. We're just flowing with these refugees. We don't know if there's a fire or what's going on. We are just terrified. And it seems to me I'm a coward at everything. It seems like a nightmare of a bad idea, what we have done. Like, I don't know what's going on. Eventually, there seems like a dominant stream. It seems, what it does seem is that they're sending the whole front of the train to the back of the train. Like, the train is being split in the night. We climb back up. Well, if it was packed before, there is no room. It's really panicky. I don't feel like a witness to anything now. I just feel part of it, Joel and I. We are in it. Like, I just want some space, somewhere to be. I want to get safely to Berlin, and I want to cross through that wall. Well, it's just, we're pushing, and those compartments are overflowing. We, like, make our way to the end of the car, and the last compartment in that car has the curtains drawn. So we give it a yank, and we give it a yank, and we hear someone scream, "Fuck." Now, I have to tell you, you cannot learn to curse like an American. You know what I'm saying? Like, I have an Israeli friend, Moti. I remember he always be like, "Not done, I give a shit." I'd be like, no, Moti, you don't give a shit. You know, like, he still can't learn it. Point is, that is a pitch-perfect fuck that I get, you know? So we're like, "Fuck, did you say fuck?" We say fuck. It's like this chorus of joyous fuck. And then the door flies open. We fly in. It slams shut. And back to me being a coward, I can tell you, you know, I don't know if I'm overreacting. There's two sort of American frat boy types there. Dudes have eyes like saucers. They are as scared and panicked as we are. Well, this is the embarrassing part of the story. It's just, this is any of you my age who backpacked then. We honestly all deeply believed that Europe was filled with small bands of, like, ninja robbers who were trained solely to rob 19-year-old Americans. Like, they wanted the bounty of, you know, half a joint and a Cowboy Junkies mixtape. This was on the black market. You could feed a family off of such bounty. The more embarrassing part of the story is we honestly believed it's so stupid. We honestly believed we would tell each other that they would gas you, that they would have like tanks of sleep, they would knock you out and then take that stuff. So we all traveled with like ropes or bicycle chains. That's how you'd lock your door. Well, guess what? These guys had the bicycle chain. We were thankful for it. That's the door was chained and people are pulling. You know what? We're not the only ones who need a space. Like, people are pulling and yanking and banging at that door and screaming. Well, the train starts moving. The banging sort of subsides. Every once in a while, there's banging and screaming, but the door's not coming open. And in the way you make home anywhere, the four of us are a team. We're a group. We're safe. The adrenaline drains out. We pass out. So we wake up in the morning. It is beautiful. I've never so enjoyed seeing in a morning like that, like sun streaming in. It is lovely. It's bucolic. It's dead silent. There's just trees out the train, and we're waiting, and we're not moving. So I go to check what's going on, and I go out into the corridor, and I very much understand why it's so silent. There's nobody else in the car. Our car is completely empty. So I look into the next car, and then I totally understand why it's empty, because there is no next car. There's no locomotive. There's no train. You know, I look behind us, same difference. We're a car alone. We've been unhooked. Like, at some point in the night, we've lost our train. So I also then understand maybe one of those people banging and pulling and screaming was a friendly conductor trying to tell us there was a second switch. I can hear you all laughing, which means you understand what's happened. I understand what's happened. Well, going back into that compartment, honestly, we had a very bad night. They're not trying to, it's a very difficult information to sort of relay to them. You know, there's no train, what do you mean there's no, like sort of this idea, like where, you know, where are we? Like, I don't know, you don't know what station? I don't know what country, you know? So again, you know, it's not hard to do recon as a group. They come out and they see we've lost the train. Well, the one thing we have with us, you know, and again, it's, you know, it's night. We don't have, you know, we don't have like our iPhones. There's no compass. Like, we know which way our bodies were hurtling through space. So we put on our packs. We open our door to the next compartment, but there is no, you know, train, next car. And we step down onto the tracks and we hike. We see a station in the distance, which is good, you know, and we hike up towards the station. And there's another fact that I have not forgotten in the 20 years since, which is when you show up at the station without the train, the platform is so much higher than you would think. But, you know, they hop up, Joel pulls me up because that's how it goes. And it's, you know, it's like 6 a.m. or something. It's just, you know, it's morning light. And then there's just one drunken blonde dude with a bottle of vodka sort of stumbling around, not scary, happy, like about our age, looking happy with a bottle of vodka on the platform. We go up to him to inquire, you know, do you speak English and what country are we in? Anyway, he does speak English. He's been out partying. He's got, you know, one leg up on us. He's finished his degree. He's been celebrating drunkenly all night. We are in the German Democratic Republic of East Germany. We are in the city of Dresden. And guess where he's going home to? He is headed home to Berlin. So our group of four, we are now 5 strong. Our train is coming. It's joyous. I really just want to get through the wall at this point. And we get on the train. We take our seats. In comes, you know, sort of out of central casting, this sort of big, strong East German woman in the very serious conductor uniforms. And she takes our tickets, and our tickets are no good. I mean, sort of try showing up at O'Hare with a ticket from LaGuardia. Like, our tickets aren't even from the same country. We have Czech tickets. We did not originate in East Germany. So the tickets are no good. So we pull out our Euro passes, which are good everywhere. And she looks at them, and she doesn't know them, and they're no good. And this is when I understand. She makes it very clear, we are being turned off at the next stop. Now, you know what? I held it together through Israel and the Intifada, and I held it together through the trip and the night. Like, you know what? Like, I'm actually terrified because, you know, I remember my mother talking about my grandparents saying, oh, yes, these relatives used to write them, you know, from across the... And then they stopped writing. You know what I'm saying? Then they were just gone. Like, this is a part of the world that swallows Jews. And you know what? Like, those refugees, like, dead serious, there's a reason they're racing. Like, that wall comes down in a day, it could go back up in a day. Half the world was already trapped behind it for all those years. Like, you know, I just think, like, what have we done? And I think back to that sort of Al-Qaeda bus tour, as I tell you now, and I think, like, do you have to be on the first bus? Like, what have we done? Anyway, so in the middle of my panic attack, Joel's trying to, like, keep me under control, and I see our German friend, he's up. He's up, and he's talking to the conductor, and he's gesticulating. He's sort of delivering the Gettysburg Address there. I mean, honestly, literally, with the light streaming through in the morning, he looks almost sober. It's beautiful. Whatever he's doing, it's beautiful. And when he's done, you know, out of nowhere, she reaches out, this conductor, with this hard face, and it goes soft, and she punches our Euro passes, and she welcomes us on the train to Berlin. So we ask him, you know, what did you tell her? And he says, I told her this. These people have come from America to our country. They've come to see our country. Are you going to tell them that a ticket that is good in Madrid, that is good in Rome, that is good in Paris, is no good here? The great conflict is over. We are one world now. We are all of us brothers. Thank you.
That was Nathan Englander. Nathan is the author of the story collections What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank and For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. When we come back, we'll hear from a documentary filmmaker struggling with how to capture the experience of domestic violence victims who are too afraid of their abusers to be filmed.
Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Catherine Burns from The Moth. Our last story is from filmmaker Ellie Lee. Back in the 1990s, Ellie worked in the trenches of the independent film world, and she told me the story you're about to hear as we stood outside at 3 o'clock in the morning on a freezing cold night, waiting for the crew to make a lighting change on set. I never forgot it, and years later asked her to tell it at a Moth show in Grand Rapids, produced with Michigan Public Radio. Here is Ellie Lee, live at the Moth.
When I was in college, I, like most people in college, I had no idea what I was doing, and I had no idea what I was supposed to study and what I was supposed to do with my life. So coming as a child of an immigrant, actually as an immigrant myself, you know, my family was rather poor when we were growing up, so we wanted to be practical, you know, and I felt this overwhelming need to study math and physics and computer science, which I did, but I never told my mom that my real passion was animation. I loved animating, and I just discovered it in college, and you know, to try to keep me grounded, you know, as I was studying all these things, I also did a lot of volunteer work at the local homeless shelter in the greater Boston area. And I loved it. I loved also being there every night and just seeing these familiar faces. And year after year, I would see a lot of the same people, unfortunately, the same men and women. And over time, I got to become really close with a lot of the women there, and I'd also noticed a pattern emerged where they were all involved in very abusive relationships with other homeless men. And late at night, you know, as they started seeing me more often and they started trusting me more over the years, they started confiding these stories about how they had all been abused as young girls, either physically or sexually, and usually by people that they trusted. It was a family member or a friend of the family. And, you know, years later, I found studies that estimated that in the Boston area, 86% of all homeless women had these kinds of histories. And I remember thinking at the time, like, why isn't this being addressed in training? Like, when I go to other shelters, like, why isn't this something that's even raised? You know, it was back in the late 80s, early 90s, and it's hard to imagine now, but back then, the idea of domestic violence was a fairly new term. It was a fairly new phenomenon to a lot of people. It had existed for a long time, but never in the public eye. It was always something that happened with a great deal of shame behind closed doors. And there was this movement to raise awareness about this issue that, you know, affected every person, regardless of socioeconomic status, you know? So, and I remember thinking, you know, that... you know, if a film or something existed that could help in training at the shelters or even for the police department, so they when they saw a situation on the streets, they would know how to approach a woman. And I decided as an undergraduate, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a documentary film about it. And I was really excited. That night I went to the shelter and I started talking to some of the women and I told them my idea and they loved it. They were like, that's great. That would be a great service to our community and that would be amazing. And I said, oh, that's perfect. So you'll be in it, right? You'll participate in the film. And they said, absolutely not. No. And of course, you know, in that moment I thought about it and I said, well, of course they're going to say no. You know, you know, I remember that a lot of the women who had confided that in these relationships, they wished that they could leave. They wished that they could break up with their boyfriends, but they were really scared. They were scared because if they ever got into a fight with their boyfriend, they would say, you know, like, don't try to hide, don't try to go somewhere, because, you know, I'll find you. There's only so many shelters in town. There's only so many meal programs. There's only so many drop-in centers, and I will find you. And the women didn't want to suffer the consequences of that. And imagine participating in a film, then all of a sudden they, you know, they're airing their dirty laundry, and the boys would find them, and they would have to suffer those consequences, you know? So I understood the women's reluctance to be involved because they were still in crisis. After getting rejected by the women, I just still felt like, well, somebody needs to make a film like this, and that's when it occurred to me, well, maybe I could make it as an animated documentary. I could use the animation, and in a way I could protect their identities and their anonymity, and it would keep them from being exposed, you know, and I can still share their stories and their experiences and shed light on this issue. And all of a sudden, it felt like my life made sense, you know, like I loved animation, and then my work at college, and then my volunteer work at the shelter, it all came together, and suddenly I felt like I had a purpose, you know, so I set off and I started interviewing a lot of homeless women and formerly homeless women. They would serve as the soundtrack for my film. And then I decided to use charcoal drawings as my animation medium. And the charcoal was perfect for me because I felt like, you know, depending on the texture of the paper, the line could be really peaceful and delicate or really violent. And somehow that could mirror the emotional journeys that a lot of the women were going through. And then as the character featured in the film, I would use a character that looked like me because I felt like I was a conduit for so much of their experiences. It kind of made sense. And in a way, it made the film even more personal. I was really, really invested in this film. And so by the time I was finished with it, and for those of you who are not familiar with animation is incredibly laborious and tedious. You know, in any given second, you have anywhere from 4 to 12 unique drawings per second. So it's incredibly time-consuming. And after a year and a half of working on this film, I had 1,000 drawings that I'd created, and I was so overjoyed because I was that much closer to finishing this film. At the same time, I was not overjoyed by the fact that I was totally broke and I had to move back in with my parents. So I called my mom and I was like, you know, can you help me move out of my place? You know, this is my last day. And she said, sure, no problem, I'll come over right now. So she comes in with a car. I didn't have that much stuff, but it all fit in one carload. And the last things to go were my artwork, and I put it in the trunk and I closed the trunk and we drove off. And we're driving on Storer Drive in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is like a very speedy, kind of windy parkway. And cars are going about 40 or 50 miles an hour. And most of the time, it's a two-lane parkway, sometimes three with no shoulder. And then it started getting cloudy. And out of nowhere, like, there was just a downpour. It's just like pouring buckets of rain. And we're driving along. And there's a really sharp turn, a very sharp left turn that you have to make on my way to home. And as my mom's making this turn, she hit a pothole, which normally would be totally fine, except for the fact that there was a problem with the trunk. When I had put my artwork in and slammed the trunk shut, I didn't realize the trunk was just really stuck but not fully locked. So it's raining. We're going 45 miles an hour. We hook this sharp left. She hits a pothole, and the trunk popped open, and only the artwork, 1,000 drawings, just slid out into two lanes of traffic in the pouring rain, and it's a rush hour, so I'm seeing all these cars drive over my artwork, and I was in a state of shock, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and I started freaking out. I was like, Mom, turn around. Please turn around. Like, this is a disaster. It took us 10 minutes to whip around, and, you know, there's no shoulder, so I'm like, stop the car, and I get out in the middle of the parkway, and there's traffic all around me, and I'm trying to salvage what I can, and as I pick up a stack of my drawings, they just melted in my hands like pulp. It was completely destroyed, everything. I'd lost everything. And by the time I got home, I just remember just sitting on my parents' couch and staring at a piece of lint on the carpet for 4 hours. I was completely catatonic. I had no idea what I was doing anymore, you know. And that year that followed, I tried desperately to recreate the film because I felt like I could resurrect it, but I was completely out of steam and out of gas. Like, I gave everything to this project. I mean, emotionally, I'd been invested in it for like 3 years, and I just didn't have anything left in me. And part of me also felt like it was torture. Like, why would I want to do this to myself again, to kind of force myself through the motions of doing something I'd already done? And it was so fragile. Like, who's to say that it's not going to get lost again when I'm done this next round? So at that point, I decided to just give up on animation completely. I just never wanted to animate ever again. So I moved on, and I tried other things, and you know, it was okay, but I felt like, you know, 5 years later, I felt this nagging pull that like was holding me back, and I felt like it was this film, you know? I had made a promise to these women when they shared their stories with me, and I felt like they deserved at least one more attempt by me to try to bring these stories to life. So I knew I needed help, so I applied for a bunch of grants, and I was very lucky to cobble together some grants so I could hire a team of animators to work with me. And 3,000 drawings later, we were done with the film, and it was amazing, right? And I was so excited, and I was starting to work on the film and edit it. When I got a phone call, I got an invitation to screen a work in progress at this new organization, a nonprofit in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called On the Rise, and they work specifically with chronically homeless women, and I thought it was just a perfect match. So I screened at their opening event, and it was, you know, attended by a small group of people, about 30 people. And afterwards, a woman came up to me, and to protect her identity, I'll call her Annie. Annie came up to me, and I just remember vividly this woman who was sort of shaking and unable to make eye contact with me. It was almost as though she felt invisible. You know, she didn't feel comfortable in her own shell. And she said, "Thank you so much for making this film. You know, you really captured what it's like to be homeless." And as we started talking, I learned a little bit more about Annie, that she'd been homeless for about a decade. She'd lost custody of her son once she started living on the streets. She was a heroin addict, and all of her friends were addicts as well. And she had just gone to a doctor because she wasn't feeling well, and the doctor had given her some bad news, that she had a life-threatening condition, and that she didn't radically change her lifestyle and get some support and help, that she would probably be dead within a year. And that was her wake-up call, and that's what brought her to On the Rise, and she was taking those first steps to get help. And I really appreciated her saying what she said about the film. I felt like, you know, I was just very touched and moved by her. And 18 months later, I was at this point a board member for On the Rise, and I was attending a luncheon, and it was a fundraiser, a small event, and I saw a woman who looked really familiar, and as I approached her, I realized it was Annie. And she looked totally different, like she looked 6 inches taller. And she was glowing and radiant and gorgeous, and she looked me directly in the eye, and you know, and everything had changed. She was no longer homeless. She was living in her own apartment. She had reconnected with her son. She, because of her advocacy work for homelessness organizations and on homeless people, she had been invited to join the board of the National Coalition for the Homeless, which is a really influential organization in Washington, D.C. She had just gotten a scholarship to go back to college, and she was going to school at night while working during the day, and she had taken her health back, and she was training for the Boston Marathon. You know, I mean, she was amazing, and I was moved to tears, and I said, "Annie, how did you do it? How did this happen?" She said, "You know, On the Rise helped me a lot. I couldn't have done it without them, but I think the moment that really changed my life was when I saw your film." And up until that point, thank you. Thanks. Up until that point, you know, I beat myself up every day for making bad decisions and finding myself in these hopeless situations and not feeling like I could do anything to get out of it. And when I saw your film, I realized I wasn't alone. And I, not only that, I recognized voices in the film. And these were women that I looked up to because they were formerly homeless and now doing something to change people's lives. Like, I didn't know Macy had suffered from a history of abuse. And I didn't know Peggy felt trapped and ashamed about her past and what had happened to her. And once I understood that it wasn't my fault, I didn't have to blame myself anymore. There was this bigger societal problem, and that it had a name, and I could defeat it, I could beat it. That at that point, I realized like I didn't have to beat myself up anymore, and I could beat this thing, and she did. You know, and looking back, you know, those 7 years of anguish and kicking myself and feeling at this incredibly low point and struggling with this film and with my career and all these questions, you know, I made this film in an attempt to save my friends, the women at the shelter. And I realized that it was the women that saved me. Thank you.
That was Ellie Lee. Ellie is a 5-time National Emmy Award nominee
and the 2009 DuPont Columbia Award winner. That's it for the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time.
Your host this hour was Catherine Burns. Catherine directed the stories in the show, along with Maggie Sino. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Janess, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Laura Haddon and Whitney Jones. Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Bill Evans, Tom McDermott and Evan Christopher, and Keith Jarrett. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.